Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 16th of December. Our guest this hour is the author of The Imperial Cruise, A Secret History of Empire and War. James Bradley is our guest. He says in the early pages of his book, when his father, John Bradley, died in 1994, his hidden memory boxes illuminated his experience as one of the six men who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. A book and a movie, both named Flags of Our Fathers, written by James, followed that story. And after writing another book about World War II in the Pacific, Flyboys, he began to wonder about the origins of America's involvement in that war. The inferno that followed Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor had consumed countless lives, and believing there's smoke before a fire, I set off to search for the original spark. And he found it in a trip in the summer of 1905. President Theodore Roosevelt dispatched the largest diplomatic delegation to Asia in U.S. history. He sent a number of members of Congress, seven senators, 23 congressmen, military and civilian officials, and also his daughter. And he sent his daughter for a specific reason that we'll hear about during the course of this hour, on an ocean liner from San Francisco to Hawaii, Japan, the Philippines, China, Korea, and then back to San Francisco. And we'll talk about the things that we don't know about, the negotiations that took place with Japan, what happened in the Philippines, what we thought our role was in the world at that time, an extension of manifest destiny, and whether or not we still hold some trace of that in the year 2009. James is actually an Antigo native. He studied at the University of Wisconsin. He is the son of John Bradley, who helped raise the American flag on Iwo Jima, and we're very happy to have him with us this hour. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, James. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Kathleen.
You have strong Wisconsin ties. You're native, huh?
I'm a cheesehead. I grew up in Antigo, graduated from the University of Wisconsin. My family, seven brothers and sisters, and my mother still live in northern Wisconsin. And my dad was that guy from Wisconsin who stands in the middle of that most reproduced photo in history of the flag raising on Iwo Jima.
Yeah. Before we get to the news story, tell me a little bit more about him. Did he talk about, or tell me about the experience, how you found out that he had done that, and a little bit about that book. It was a bestseller for a long time.
Well, we grew up knowing that my father was in the middle of that photo, but that's all we knew because he wouldn't talk about it. And then after my dad died in 1994, my mom sent me a copy of a letter that she found in his boxes. He had written home from Iwo Jima 2 days after the flag raising, and he was 22 years old, and he wrote to his parents in Appleton that it was the happiest moment in his life, that flag raising. And I cried when I read that letter, wondering why my dad had been unable to share that happy moment with me. So I didn't set out to write a book. I set out to find why did my dad not talk about Iwo Jima, and I found the answer, and that answer is in Flags of Our Fathers.
Mm-hmm. This, what you write about in this new book is such an important part of American history, and yet it is so little known. Why is that, James?
You know, I would love to know, Kathleen. The New York Times wrote two articles on this book so far, and they're asking the same questions. Why historians have overlooked all this material, I don't know if it's intentional or just taste. A narrow thing is I did not set out to write a full biography of Theodore Roosevelt or his administration. I just looked at narrowly at this cruise. In 1905, they took this major cruise that you outlined to Asia, and 100 years later, in the summer of 2005, I traveled in its wake, and I have to tell you, I was shocked, somewhere near bewildered by the hidden history that I was able to find.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that it's a history of our problems with race and indeed racism on the part of some of our leaders?
It's a problem of looking at foreign countries through ideological lenses, of really not understanding what's going on. Theodore Roosevelt in 1905, this was an East Coast Eurocentric country. Roosevelt didn't know anything about Asia. He had met few Asians. So he looked at Asia through the theories that he learned at Harvard and Columbia, and he based American foreign policy and American interest in the 20th century on theories that didn't hold water, as it turned out, and led to four wars in Asia.
Theories like manifest destiny?
Theories like the Chinese were a declining race. They were impotent. They were like a balloon that had lost their air. So Roosevelt looked at 400 million Chinese and declared that they would have nothing to say about the future of Asia. Didn't even bother to consult them on his policies towards China because they didn't matter. They were going to go away. And then the Japanese were a potent race. They were a rising race. So he invested the Japanese with power and made secret deals with them to help America take over China. And, you know, it's just a bunch of gibberish 100 years later, but at the time, he was basing American foreign policy on these ideas.
And why did he like the Japanese better?
Well, the Japanese, you know, we've got to go back to the 19th century. The white Western Christians hit Asia, and Asia refuses to change. The Chinese are still wearing ponytails and long robes. And Japan was the only country to industrialize, militarize, and modernize. And the Japanese said to Roosevelt, "Hey, President Roosevelt, look at us. We've got railroads and telegraph wires, and we're eating bread, and we're dressing in Brooks Brothers, and look at those Asians." So the Japanese said, "Mr. President, Japan is a separate nation geographically. We're an island nation, not part of Asia. And just like we're not part of Asia geographically, we're different culturally. We're more like you, Americans, and you can trust us to not only assimilate American values, but to take those values into Asia." And Roosevelt trusted the Japanese military, as strange as it sounds, to help America out in Asia.
Hmm. You write, Roosevelt says, "Our future history will be more determined by our position on the Pacific facing China than our position on the Atlantic facing Europe." What all did he have in mind?
Well, you know, in 1941, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt criticized the bombing at Pearl Harbor as a sneak attack. But that was the second time Japan bombed a Western country to start a major war. In 1904, when the Japanese hit the Russians at Port Arthur in a sneak attack, Theodore Roosevelt looked at it and said, "I was thoroughly well pleased with the Japanese victory because the Japs are playing our game." Hmm. This was the key. What was the game? What game was Japan playing, and what game was Roosevelt playing with Japan? I found to my shock that in the summer of 1905, President Theodore Roosevelt agreed a secret treaty with Japan that lit the long fuse on the events that we would later call Pearl Harbor and World War II in the Pacific, the events that would send my dad from Appleton, Wisconsin, out to the island of Iwo Jima.
And tell me how, I know we got a lot of history to cover here, but tell me how that secret treaty led to that so many years later, to World War II.
Well, you know, Theodore Roosevelt won the Nobel Peace Prize for bringing the Russians and the Japanese together during this imperial cruise in 1905. But unknown to the Russians and unknown to the Nobel Peace Prize Committee, Roosevelt was acting as a secret agent of Japan at this point. He wrote to his son, "Don't tell anybody I'm acting at the direction and at the request of the Japanese. Keep it secret." He got the Russians and the Japanese to the negotiating table, but unknown to the Nobel Peace Prize Committee and unknown to Congress, he agreed a secret treaty to give Japan Korea. Now, why is this key? We got to go forward to Pearl Harbor. We look at Pearl Harbor as an invasion of the United States, but it wasn't. Pearl Harbor, I realized, was an attack only against American ships to keep them from interfering with the Japanese game. The Japanese game was expansion in Asia. At the time that Japan hit Pearl Harbor, they landed 85,000 troops in Malaysia. Japan didn't invade Hawaii. They could have taken it. They didn't invade California. What they wanted to do was to continue to expand in Asia. The first step of that expansionism had to be Korea. And it was in 1905 that President Theodore Roosevelt, believing he was acting for the good of America's future, allowed Japan to take Korea. The first step in the problem that Franklin Delano Roosevelt would later confront was approved, anointed, and encouraged by President Theodore Roosevelt in the summer of 1905.
Mm-hmm. And they were worried in the 1940s that we were going to start expansion in Asia. They were worried about our history in the Philippines. What were they worried about when it came to us?
You know, that America, we think of Pearl Harbor as this huge event that Japan attacked us. If you go to Tokyo and you're looking at it from the perspective of the Japanese, Pearl Harbor was a relatively minor event. It was just a swatting away of the American military, and when they sunk some ships, they returned to Japan. Their game was expanding in Asia, mm-hmm. and the only military might that America had in Asia was in the Philippines and in Pearl Harbor, and Japan hit them both. And they thought we were merchants, that we were commercial-minded people, and we would not come out and fight. Japan had expanded from Korea to Manchuria to China, and they felt they needed to expand into Southern Asia to bring their wars to a close. So what Japan wanted to do in the 1940s was just wrap up the game in Asia. But that game was anointed and approved by Theodore Roosevelt back in 1905 on this imperial cruise.
Mm-hmm. So do historians look then at his being awarded the Nobel Prize after securing this kind of sham Russian-Japanese togetherness? Did anybody say, wait a second, maybe we should have second thoughts about this?
No, because what I'm telling you, what your listeners are hearing right now, was unknown during Theodore Roosevelt's lifetime. Only two people knew about it, Roosevelt and his Secretary of War. Not even Roosevelt's ambassador to Japan knew. So if this was 1905 and I was telling you this, it was nonsensical because this was kept completely a secret. The Japanese leadership knew, the Japanese emperor knew, but no one in America other than Theodore Roosevelt and his yes man, Secretary of War William Howard Taft, knew. Huh. So Roosevelt went to his grave with the Nobel, and no one knew of his secret agreements. Later, when they were discovered piecemeal, there were names redacted, they were deep in some, hidden in his papers, and what I did is I lined up all the correspondence of Theodore Roosevelt's life in the summer of 1905, a vast trove of information. And the reader can see that Roosevelt was hot to trot to anoint the Japanese as the first into Asia to be a play stop, a door holder for American power.
Hmm. It sort of counters the image that we have of President Roosevelt, doesn't it? We tend to think of him as a progressive guy, an environmentalist, a guy who took on companies that were too powerful in this country. Did it diminish your doing this story? Did it diminish your opinion of him? Does it diminish our opinion, or were people pretty strange on certain kinds of issues that seem to guide us now, that America was mightier than anybody else and in some senses, the Caucasian race was the best to rule the world?
Well, you know, there's a reason there's not one historian in the country, and history is more complex. Roosevelt was more multifaceted than just the guy up on Mount Rushmore.
Right.
And, you know, Roosevelt thought this was a great progressive move. He saw Japan as a rising race and the Chinese as a sinking race. And with his progressive modern mind, he thought that by empowering the Japanese to help America take over Asia, he was doing good. He was bringing an advanced civilization to Asia. But it didn't work out that way. He lit the firecrackers on the events that would later send my father and millions of other fathers out there to Asia to deal with a big problem. But at the time, Roosevelt was proud that he was dealing with this in a very progressive manner.
Hmm. It's interesting if he were alive today now to see who the superpower is, right?
Yeah. It was almost strange dealing with the material, because after the when he invited the Russians and the Japanese to negotiate after the Russo-Japanese War, they were negotiating over Chinese territory, but he didn't invite the Chinese to the table because he was sure they would have nothing to do with the future of Asia. He dismissed 400 million people, and you wonder if the attitudes... Roosevelt was out front when it came to trust busting. He was out front in terms of conservation, and we have to applaud him every time we take a look at our national park system. If he had been as foresighted with Asian affairs, maybe we would not have fought four wars in Asia in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. So then, James, how did he get so misguided on that issue? Who was he listening to? Who was he reading? Why did that happen?
Well, it happened because, again, we have to go back. You know, we can't be too critical in the sense that this is 1905. America was a Eurocentric country. We didn't know Asia. We weren't translating each other's newspapers and books. Asia was the mysterious Orient, and very little contact between the East and West, number one. Number two, if you look in the book, you'll see that at Harvard and at Columbia and his advisors, he was being told these theories that, you know, there were declining races and there were ascending races. There were impotent races and there were potent races. Mm-hmm. England was circling the globe. They had India, Egypt, Singapore, Hong Kong. America had just taken over this huge continent. Another white race, the Russians, had taken over vast swaths of territory. The Chinese were having difficulty internally. So these theories made some sense when he looked at a globe in his office in the White House, and there was one bright spot, and that was Roosevelt couldn't get the troops from Congress. He wanted to expand into Asia. Then he saw the Japanese army, and he said, the Japanese are the most dashing fighters in the world. And the Japanese said, Mr. Roosevelt, you know, we'll be kind of a rent-a-army for you. We will take American values into Asia. So this was a bright spot in Theodore Roosevelt's mind that the Japanese would represent the Americans in Asia. So out of the goodness of his heart with benevolent intentions, Theodore Roosevelt greenlights the Japanese military expansionism that my father would later have to go to Iwo Jima to put a stop to.
We welcome phone calls for you, James, and we'll take them in just one moment. James Bradley is our guest this hour. His latest book, he's the author of several New York Times bestsellers. He's the son of John Bradley, one of the men who raised the flag at Iwo Jima, and he is a graduate of the University of Wisconsin and grew up in Anaco. His latest book is The Imperial Cruise, A Secret History of Empire and War. He looks at the secrets untold until James Bradley himself shared the story of those soldiers in New York Times' Flags of Our Fathers, the image, the story of the U.S. Marines raising the flag at Iwo Jima. And this particular story is the relatively unknown story of what happened in 1905 when Teddy Roosevelt dispatched the largest diplomatic mission in U.S. history. And what happened subsequently gave James a much better understanding of his father's service in World War II. So that's what we're talking about. To your phone calls in a moment. The email address is talk@wpr.org. The phone is 800-486-8655. And just a brief reminder, Carl Castle, as you know, who's been with National Public Radio for such a long period of time and has covered so many important stories, we're just going to do a brief interview with him, not on the air, but we're going to post it on Facebook, something new for us. So if there are questions you would like to ask Carl Castle, we're asking you to go to Facebook right now and write those down, and then I'll include them and we'll post our interview on Facebook later today. So the Facebook address is, Facebook. And then you go to the Kathleen Dunn Show and post some questions for us. We'll use them. To move phone calls for James in a moment, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, and let's start with Dave from Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Dave.
Good morning, Kathleen, and good morning, Mr. Bradley. I have to commend you on your two earlier books. I grew up during World War II, and I've devoured everything about it. Those were as good of a good of books about war as I've read.
Thank you.
I have a couple of questions. I read the review of your most recent book, and yesterday at coffee with a few friends, I brought it up, and one of the friends kind of suggested that your father would be pretty upset with you for writing this, what he called an excuse for the Japanese actions in World War II. And I'd be interested in your comment on that. And the second question, I read a book recently. The name of, I don't recall the author, the name of it is Human Smoke. And it goes back to prior to World War I, and it's a compilation of newspaper articles, letters, correspondence from among governmental agencies and so forth up prior to World War I and through World War II. And it's almost a litany of misguided efforts to do things that have unintended results. And that seems to be what you're describing in your book. And I'm wondering if you had read that particular book and you were familiar with that author's take on misapplied power and the law of unintended circumstances and consequences. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
Dave, first of all, thank you for your service and thank you for those questions. I didn't read the book that you mentioned, and I have a feeling that your friend at coffee there didn't read my book, The Imperial Cruise, either, because I'm not doing what he's suggesting. All I'm doing is saying here that our histories say that World War II in the Pacific began with Pearl Harbor. And the Japanese, much to our surprise, had expansionist tendencies in Asia. What I'm documenting here is that there was a time when another Roosevelt applauded Japanese expansionism in Asia. In 1932, 13 years after Roosevelt's death, Japan was expanding into Manchuria, and the Americans wondered why. Time magazine wrote from Tokyo that the Japanese feel they have a Japanese Monroe Doctrine for Asia. Hmm. America had South America, and Japanese felt that they should have Asia. And Time magazine scratched their head and said that the Japanese feel that this was a policy initiated by President Theodore Roosevelt. That didn't make any sense to Time magazine because they were still unaware of this secret treaty. So I'm just pointing out a time when America thought it was a great idea for Japan to expand into Asia.
Thanks very much, Dave, for your call. We go next to Mike from Milwaukee. Hello, Mike.
Yes, hi. So are you saying that, I thought I heard you say that FDR then was caught unaware, but it seems to me, didn't Congress or FDR put a restriction on naval development, some kind of ratio, battleships, cruisers, destroyers, and then because the Japanese broke that agreement, we imposed an oil embargo on them? Supposedly that's what caused the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Now, is this history now altered because of your findings?
Thanks for that question. A few things that you're saying in there are true, and then we can get into about 30 years of discussion here. Well, what I'm saying is every 30-year marriage that ends in a divorce has a first kiss. And so, yes, I mean, the reason we're getting divorced is because you spilled the coffee. No, the reason we're getting divorced is because you burnt the toast. So there were many, many reasons that led up to the break between America and Japan. What I'm documenting here is that in the summer of 1905, and that's where this book ends, on this Imperial Cruise, there was a time when an American president thought that for Japan to expand into Asia was a good idea for the world and a good idea for American national security, and he inked a secret treaty. This was an unconstitutional act, and I think it's a cautionary tale. The Founding Fathers designed a constitution where the Senate is supposed to look at the agreements that presidents make. In this case, Roosevelt wrote, "I don't believe the Senate is a good body to make foreign treaties, and I'm going to act alone and make a wise foreign policy myself."
Thanks very much for the call. Let's spend a few minutes, if you don't mind, on the Philippines, which was a U.S. action that preceded what you were talking about in a horrible incident and very underreported in American history. What were Roosevelt's thoughts about what had taken place in the Philippines? And does this play into our conversation at all now?
Well, in the Philippines, we went to the Philippines because they were being ruled by Spain. And the Filipinos had a revolutionary army, and they were fighting their war of independence, just like George Washington had fought ours. The Filipinos welcomed the American military ashore, thinking that they would help, that the American military would help the Filipinos against Spain, like France helped George Washington against the British. But the Americans turned the tables and made an agreement with Spain that Spain would leave and America would replace Spain as the colonial master, much to the shock of the Filipinos, and that launched a long insurrection. When I got to the Philippines in the summer of 2005, 100 years after this imperial cruise, I read that President Roosevelt had declared mission accomplished in the Philippines and that all was peaceful. I went down to the southern Muslim part of the Philippines, and the Filipino officials wouldn't let me out of my hotel room without an armed police guard.
Oh my.
100 years after Theodore Roosevelt said a mission accomplished, we are still fighting in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm. And why is it that we have paid so little attention to that and how it may have influenced what people think of us in that part of the world and how that influenced subsequent events? There were so many people. It was a really bloody event, and so many people were massacred, really.
Well, yeah, there's estimates that somewhere between 250,000 and 1,000,000 Filipinos died. This was our first quagmire out in Asia, and, you know, it was far away. You're talking about a time when it took 2 months for the fastest ships to make the trip to the Philippines and back. So there was little actual reporting other than what the government gave out. We invaded in 1898. In 1905, when the Imperial cruise landed, we were still battling, but again, Roosevelt continued to tell America that mission had been accomplished and all was peaceful.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next. Thank you very much for your call, Mike. We go to Ken from Fox Valley next. Hi, Ken.
Oh, good morning. James, just a personal note. You're a Wisconsin lad, same here. Did you actually live in the Appleton area where your father was a resident of when you were a youth, let's say your teen years?
No, sir, I did not. My father and my mother are from Appleton, and my dad came back from the war, and my mom and dad moved to Antigo, Wisconsin, home of the Red Robins.
There you go.
And raised a family of eight in Antigo.
There you go. Then you are not the same James Bradley I went to school with. However, now, digressing from that, later, the Wilson administration took some rather interesting detours in world policy. What of this 1905 expedition would have influenced, or was there any influence on what later doctrine and moves were made by the Wilson administration?
Well, that's a great question, but I'm going to leave that for my next book, if you don't mind, because this book, The Imperial Cruise, stops at 1905. And what I'm pointing out here is that it lit the long fuse. There are other incendiary actions that, you're right, that did happen during the Wilson and Roosevelt administrations. But the Imperial Cruise is a story of America's policies in 1905 at every stop. They stopped in Hawaii, Japan, China, Korea, and the Philippines, and it's a peek into a time of hidden history that has just not been delved into.
And when you were there 100 years later, what did the people in the Philippines have to say to you about what happened there 100 years previously? Were there bitter memories still?
You know, this is fascinating because I met with top historians and I said, where are these concentration camps and massacre sites and everything that's documented in the Library of Congress? You know, I can find the paper, but where are the sites? And they said that because America ruled there for so long and controlled the educational system, it had just been cleansed from the memory banks. You know, in Vietnam, we lost in 75, and the memory was still there, and you can go downtown Saigon and see the museums. After the insurrection of the early 1900s, we controlled the books and we controlled the printing presses for another two, three generations. But there were surprises all over Asia I stumbled upon. You can imagine my surprise when I'm in China walking where the Americans walked, and I stumble upon the fortune of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Franklin Delano Roosevelt inherited his money from Warren Delano, his grandpa on his mother's side. And out in China, I learned that Grandpa Delano had been the American opium king of China.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, no.
And so if listeners are saying what and shocked by some of the things that they're hearing about this book, they can join the club because I was amazed that there was this much hidden history out there 100 years later.
Ooh, even the Kennedys couldn't keep their history with Joe Kennedy hidden that long, huh?
Yeah, that's no comment on Franklin Delano Roosevelt, but I couldn't understand why I had gotten a degree in East Asian history and had no idea that, you know, Warren Delano, grandpa of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, was selling drugs out there, illegal drugs out there in China, with the founder of Princeton University.
Oh, my gosh.
Cabot House up in Harvard was the product of an opium dealer. So I think that people who want to discover some history that they can hardly imagine will enjoy this book.
Right. I think you need to put a sign up in front of that house at Harvard to let people know that little-known fact about American history, don't you think, James?
Well, I'll tell them you suggested
okay.
that.
All right. Thanks, Ken, for your call. We go next to Paul from La Crosse. Hi, Paul.
Good morning. Yes, mentioned in the introduction was Alice Roosevelt. And I read a biography about her last year and didn't really hear much of this except how bored she was, how hot she was, and how she was expected to be the hostess for all the parties and receptions that they held on this cruise. In your book, what was her real function there? Did she have an undercover role, or was it just to be the figurehead for the president?
That's a great question, and I think if there's such a word, she had an outer cover role. Theodore Roosevelt was the first public relations president. He was the first one to have a child of his represent himself in foreign countries. We're used to it now with the Ford children and Bush children, but Alice Roosevelt was the first. She was the most famous woman in America, Princess Alice, they called her, and it was a brilliant PR move. When Alice went to Japan, Korea, China, these different countries, there were throngs of people craning their necks to see this 21-year-old gorgeous American princess, and it was a great cover as Americans back in the United States were looking at pictures of her viewing the fat tummies of sumo wrestlers. Secretary of War Taft, who was also on the cruise, was in a room making secret deals with the Japanese prime minister that we didn't find out about until generations later.
Hmm. And tell me a little bit more about her personality. She was a pretty feisty gal, huh?
Alice was a feisty gal. She had her own pistol. She appeared in public with a boa constrictor around her neck. She smoked cigarettes. She got caught for speeding when hardly anyone drove a car, and women didn't. And she was rebellious. And what she was rebelling against was the very, very difficult relationship she had with her father, Theodore Roosevelt. Alice's mother died in childbirth, and Theodore Roosevelt remarried. And he never wanted to talk about Alice's mother. So Alice got into adulthood, and Theodore Roosevelt died, went into his grave, and father and daughter never discussed the mother. And Alice writes in her diary that she's angry about this, she's becoming twisted about this, and it's hard to explain, but Theodore Roosevelt never in his life admitted to or discussed Alice's mother with her.
Mm-hmm.
And it bothered her a great deal.
That's amazing. And did she serve her purpose then? Was the press totally devoted to covering her?
You know, it was brilliant. They would show up. They showed up in the Philippines where the Chamber of Commerce told Secretary of War Taft that the economy was collapsing. There was widespread malnutrition because of military operations. But the press was all about the how many stitches in the dress she wore and how she shook 5,000 hands in one evening. And she represented the purity of the American girl, one newspaper said. So Alice generated the headlines while Theodore Roosevelt's minions did their secret work behind the scenes.
Huh. Compare her to somebody who's before the public eye now, can you?
She was the Jackie Kennedy of her day.
Oh.
She was, if you say the word Cher or Britney or Madonna, just one word, everybody knows what you mean. If you say Madonna, you know who that is and you know what she stands for. In 1905, if you said Alice, there was only one Alice. It was Princess Alice Roosevelt. Women wore Alice blue dresses. She could stop a city when it was announced that she was going to be there. A fabulous magnetic personality.
Huh. More phone calls in just one moment. Our number 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. James Bradley is our guest, son of John Bradley, one of the men who raised the flag at Iwo Jima. His latest book is The Imperial Cruise, A Secret History of Empire and War. He's also the author of a couple other books, which I'm sure that many of you are familiar with, because one was a bestseller for a long period of time, Flags of Our Fathers, and another book on World War II in the Pacific, Flyboys. We have one line open, should you care to join our conversation. And just a reminder, if you want to send some questions to us, we're going to do a short interview with Carl Castle, who is retiring, and a wonderful NPR news caster. So we're going to do that shortly after 11, and then post the interview on Facebook. So we're asking you on Facebook to, if you want to have some questions answered, here's a way for you to ask your questions. Just go to Facebook and then the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we'll get your questions and pass them along to Carl. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls, and we go to Betty from Oak Creek. Hello, Betty. Hello, Betty. Betty's not there anymore. Dave from Wausau. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Kathleen and James. Great show. James, I'm a Keith from Wausau. I'm sorry, Kathleen, I had to drop a name. My father, John Keith, flew the OS-2U down in Trinidad during the war, and he had a brother who flew the B-25H in a composite Chinese-American squadron in Burma. And they had a policy, I'm calling mostly to give you homage here, and I'll get to it here. They had a policy, he was shot down, he saved his whole crew, he landed that thing softly. They marched with Chiang Kai-shek for a month before they got back to to the Allies in safety. And it's just a great and riveting story. Where my homage to you comes in here is, when I read Flyboys, the work that you did in your effort to enable the reader to understand why the Japanese were the way they were, why they had the audacity they had, why they resorted to things like cannibalism and why they were so ruthless with prisoners gave me a much deeper understanding of what my uncle faced in Burma and why they had a policy of not letting them go back into combat once they had survived a combat mission, a failed combat mission or crash. So I want to thank you for going through all that work in Flyboys to help we, the readers. I gained an understanding of the Japanese going into that period of history that I never had before. So thank you for that, sir, and keep writing. You're a wonderful writer.
Thank you so much.
That was nice, huh? Thanks. We go next to Betty. I think Betty's with us now from Oak Creek. Hello, Betty.
Thank you for taking my call. And
sure.
I'm sorry, my phone, I hit the wrong button.
Oh, yet. That'll happen. I gotcha.
I had, I don't know, heard this and so much, not too often, but I think it was Dorothy Dick, Dixon was a psychic, and she had, had told Franklin Roosevelt that the world leader, and I don't know how many years, would be Red China. And his comment was that there was no Red China. And now, was there anything to that, or is that just a...
Ma'am, I'm unfamiliar with that comment. I'm thinking of doing a book on FDR and China, so you're going to have to wait 5 years for me to figure out, to find that quote and comment on it. I'm sorry.
FDR and China is next. Are you sure about that, James?
No, I'm not sure, but I'm toying with it. Never sure until... Till you delve into it, the
right.
The Imperial Cruise, this third book, took me 6 years, and so it, you know, you've got to delve into the archives and look around for a couple of years just to find the story.
Yeah, and then you have to take the journey. Why was that important to you to recreate the journey?
It was important because I was up at Bass Lake, Wisconsin, with my family, and I had been reading well over 100 books about Asia in the lead-up to World War II, and I realized that the summer of 1905 was a critical year with America and Asia, but I didn't know why. And then I saw, wow, Theodore Roosevelt, this powerful president, dispatches the largest diplomatic delegation to Asia in U.S. history. And then I looked and I realized it was in August of 1905. So I just thought there'd be something magical about going back 100 years to the month and standing in Asia where the Americans stood and seeing what I could find. And as I said, I went out there with trepidation thinking I might not find much, but I was shocked by the hidden history that's revealed in this book.
And what about what you learned in terms of the good that's happened or the negative things that have happened in the subsequent 100 years? Were you greeted with suspicion in places you thought you would be greeted warmly? Were you greeted warmly everywhere?
I was greeted very warmly. I went to school in Asia many years ago. I've traveled throughout Asia quite a bit, and I enjoy it. I think what I found was that if we are going to dispatch the American military overseas, we shouldn't be relying on theories that that Americans can discuss in a room in Washington. It's different talking, you know, it's sitting in Wisconsin and talking about Texas is different than going down there and dealing with the reality. So I realized that in the summer of 1905, Roosevelt was dealing with Asia through ideological lenses. That's one thing. The other thing is, hey, the founding fathers designed a constitution that says that the Senate has to vet treaties that presidents make. Roosevelt went around the Senate in this case with disastrous results.
And what about the lessons that we learn from 1905 in terms of dispatching troops now and in terms of a philosophy? Is it a similar philosophy or a different philosophy that was in operation then of America's role in the world, America's needing to be a powerful force in Asia?
Well, you know, we say to ourselves that Americans fight for liberty and democracy. In this book, you'll see that Theodore Roosevelt firmly believed that the future of Asia was not democracy, that Asians should not rule themselves. The founder of political science, Professor John Burgess at Columbia, explicitly taught Theodore Roosevelt that Asians cannot control their own affairs because it is the white man who invented the state. And he said invented the organs of state, and that it must be white men who control the organs of state. So there was this belief that America and England had to go out there and take control of these countries if anything was going to happen. That sort of belief system led to military involvement. We fought in Vietnam. We fought all over the Pacific in World War II. I'm not questioning what my dad did in Iwo Jima. I'm just wondering if he had to be there at all.
Thanks, Betty, for the call. Judy from Stillwater, Minnesota. Hi, Betty. Or Judy.
Judy, hi.
Hi, Judy.
Well, I'm really excited about this because I'm wondering if there is a way for me to get a list of the crew that went on the ship, because my family's story, which accompanies a tea set I have here from Japan, which I inherited, was acquired on that trip by my great-grandfather. And the story goes that he was working in his florist shop in North Minneapolis, and he got a knock on the door. A recruitment officer took him off to the Navy, and he went on this cruise, and my grandmother and the family had to make do without him while he was gone because he was the water maker on the ship. And my dad would explain how they had to make fresh water out of salt water when they were crossing long distances.
Oh, is that fascinating?
That's amazing.
Huh. Is there a way for me to, you know, actually see his name on a list or anything? Because I don't have that kind of proof, but I've sure got a beautiful tea set.
Well, you know, go to jamesbradley.com. First of all, look in the book. In the beginning, Alice and Secretary Taft are talking about who's on the cruise, and see if his name is there, and look in the notes.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the first step. And if you can't find it through those sources, go to jamesbradley.com and send me an email. And when I get back home, I can think of some source material. I don't know if the list goes down that far. I was looking at those lists about 4 years ago, so off the top of my head, I can't tell you, but you've got the tea set, so why don't we take the step to figure it out?
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you,
Judy.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
It's a great call. I love calls like that. Listening at the right time, and who knew, now maybe she can get verification.
Right.
Mark from Eau Claire, hi.
Good morning. I'm originally from Antigo.
Oh.
And I have to tell James that shortly after his first book came out, I got it. And it was shortly after my father had died. He was a World War II bombardier in the South Pacific. And not as dramatic as James' discoveries of what he found in his father's closet, but we found some diaries and other things in my father's papers. And I just was reading those at the same time your book came out, and I got your book, and I read the first few pages, and I just sobbed. Mm. It was really quite a moving experience, because similar to your revelations, we had some in our own family.
Mm.
So, thank you.
Yes, sir.
And
thanks for your dad's service.
All right. Thank you, James.
Yeah, thank you so much for the call. Well, James, thank you so much for being with us. It was just such an interesting hour. And you're quite a writer. It's nice to have people from Wisconsin who have read your work as well and given you praise. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. This is the most exciting interview I've done. It's nice to have at least my voice back there in Wisconsin land.
Yes, it's nice to have you here. James Bradley, our guest this hour, and his latest book is The Imperial Cruise, A Secret History of Empire and War. He is also the author of the New York Times bestseller, Flags of Our Fathers, and his second book, Flyboys, and now this book, which is highlighting a piece of American history that we don't hear very much about, President Theodore Roosevelt's 1905 diplomatic mission to Asia, and the story of why he sent his daughter, Alice, as well. But there are a lot of stories in this book, pretty meaningful. Thanks to Carmen Jackson and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. And you may know by now that Carmen Jackson has retired, which is hard to believe. She's been here long time and has produced many shows for us. We will continue our friendship with her, but I did want to thank her publicly for all that she has done and her special ability to attract great authors and to have a real feel for what each of our shows are individually. She's has been a real treasure. So I'll miss her and wish her well. I just want to remind you also, we have so many things to remind you about. We're going to do a brief interview with Carl Castle that we're going to post on Facebook. We haven't done this before, but we're trying to use Facebook more. And I'm going to do that shortly, but it won't be on the air. It will be on Facebook. So if you have any questions, just zip those to us as soon as you can, because we're going to interview him pretty shortly. Go to Facebook and then the Kathleen Dunn Show and post us a question, and we hope that we can give it to Carl. And then you can go back to Facebook and hear the interview and maybe your question. Won't that be fun? Until tomorrow, thanks very much for listening. It's a minute before 11. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.